The following is a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.
Welcome back to another Kiefer and Curry show. He is Kip Kiefer, of course, executive director of the Birmingham Racecourse Casino, and all around just a wonderful guy, great father, and just a fun guy to do a show with. I'm Tony Curry, and co-host of this show and owner of Tony Curry Radio. And this is a little show, Kip, that we just kind of pick little topics here. We talk about them. Sometimes we talk about things like pickleball or talk about family situations. Today, though, I want to go back to sports and talk about, and you and I have done a lot of reminiscing, a lot of sentimental things going on the show, and I love it. It's therapeutic for me. But I was thinking about Peter Edward Rose the other day, and I don't know why I was thinking about him, but I thought about him a lot when I was 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, going through the Big Red Machine days. And I got a great story I want to tell you about Pete Rose. But I was thinking, why don't we do the people that influenced us or we think about the most as children when it comes to sports? Because, man, there were so many. Sports were so different back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Now it's all about the money. I see the NBA free agency, and it's like no one's got loyalty to anything. It's all about chasing the big bucks and getting the max contracts. That goes pretty much for any sporting event. You know, it used to be back in the day, Pete Rose played, I think, 22 years with the Cincinnati Reds before they finally let him go. He went to Philadelphia, the Expos, and came back with the Reds as a manager. But you just don't see players staying with any particular teams for long periods of time. We've actually done a show on that, which, by the way, you can hear on the Tony Curry Radio Podcast Network or anywhere on the TKR app. But I wanted you to start off. And first of all, I hope you're doing well. Don't forget the Need to Know show that's on every single week as well right here on Tony Curry Radio. But some of our favorite childhood heroes when it comes to sports. First of all, how you doing, brother?
I'm doing great, Tony. I love the topic. Of course, my childhood was sports obsessed, and that has kind of carried over into my adulthood, of course, as I have carved out a semblance of a living and pursuing those passions. But the better residual of all that is that my oldest son Case, who has joined us for some programming, has just been a superstar, rising star in the sports writing and broadcasting world, and so it's all paid off. So I love sports, and it's given me so much, and I love reminiscing about these great memories.
So give me a guy that all you gotta do is go back to your teenage years and you're like, oh man, I used to follow that player, I used to love that player. Who was it?
Well, I'm going to go back further than that. I'm going to go back when I was basically in kindergarten and first grade with my opening one here. And it might surprise you, you said a guy. Well, he was a guy, kind of, but he had four legs and had his privates removed. It was a racehorse by the name of Kelso, who is a Hall of Famer, was running predominantly in the Washington, D.C. circuit in Laurel and Bowie and Pimlico, but also on the New York circuit in the big races then. My dad and I's first bond was definitely through horse racing. My dad went every Saturday to whichever track in the Washington, D.C. area was open. And at the ripe old age of 4 or 5 years old, I was tagging along. And I've joked, we've talked about this a little bit on previous shows, that by the time I was in second grade, I was a better handicapper than he was. I learned quickly and became, you know, totally into it. But the superstar horse during that era in the mid-60s was a horse named Kelso, who had been let's call him a spirited young horse who didn't have his mind on his business. I still think it's hilarious, Tony, and a lot of people might think this is funny. You still see all the time horses come in for their first start as two-year-olds or perhaps three-year-olds, and the horse is strutting around. These are the male horses. It's just like a singles bar on the Jersey Shore or, you know, Hernando's Hideaway or some of the famous places that you go to display your wares. But these young horses strut around the paddock, and they are kind of strutting their stuff for everybody to see. And, you know, it's hilarious that the commentator just dismisses that behavior as, well, the so-and-so five-horse old Joe making his debut is acting very studdish in the paddock. So they don't really like that in racehorses. They want them focused not on the on the fillies and mares, but on the job at hand at the track. So it's a common practice when they can't get a horse's attention as a youngster to go ahead and geld that horse. I was doing a seminar once at the Birmingham race course about horse racing, and someone said, the number seven horse in the first race is gelded. What does that mean? Is that important? And I said, well, it is to him. One of my great comebacks. But Kelso, Tony, was just a phenom. He was running in all the big races, and that was a whole different era. I remember, I really have great memories. I think I was in the second grade. My dad even came to school and checked me out on a like lunchtime on a Thursday unexpectedly, because Kelso was running that afternoon at Laurel Park in Washington, which is still operating, by the way, in the Washington, D.C. International, where all these horses from that had been bred in foreign countries, and he was the American representative in the race. And it was the biggest thrill for me. I was at the track on a Tuesday afternoon when I was supposed to be at school. Is this a great country or what? So I have such great memories of Kelso. I watched on a Labor Day. He ran up in New York in a big stakes race at Belmont, and actually didn't win. He had had about an 11 or 12 race win streak and was beaten, ran second. And I was so despondent. I could not believe that Kelso lost. This was on a Saturday on Wide World of Sports, because horse racing was not typically telecast, of course, in those days. Jim McKay and the boys, the constant variety of sports, the thrill of victory, the agony of defeat. Kelso was beaten that day, and my dad explained to me, well, they put so much weight on him that, it was really too much to ask, and I just kind of nodded like I knew what he was talking about. I didn't know 2 years later that meant they had loaded down his saddle with extra weights, which they do in a horse race, to even it out, sort of. So it was a little bit of equality and equity and all that stuff that we're living with now to balance the scales in horse racing. But Kelso, my first sports hero when I was a very young man.
And we got our first animal on our show. I love that. That's perfect. This is the Kiefer and Curry Show. We're talking about our childhood heroes growing up. And, you know, I lived in Cincinnati till I was about 19, moved to Louisville and came down here back in 1988. And, of course, I was a big Red Machine fan. I was a Cincinnati Reds fan. Didn't get a chance to go see a lot of games at Riverfront. My dad used to tell me stories about going to Crosley Field at that time, point in time. There were so many holes in the fence. You could just stand behind the center field fence, just look through the hole with your binoculars and see a ball game for free. We couldn't do that at Riverfront Stadium. But I'm going to go 5 years before the call of the 1975 Major League Baseball team, the Cincinnati Reds, who won 108 games, won 108-54 during the regular season. A lot of people would say it was one of the greatest baseball teams. You had Tony Perez at first. You had David Concepcion at shortstop. You had Joe Morgan at second. You had Pete Rose at third. You had Cesar Geronimo, Ken Griffey Jr., and a guy named George Foster, who launched 52 bombs in the outfield. And you had Don Gullett on the mound. And you had this guy named Johnny Bench behind the plate. Man, when I heard about Mike Piazza, all I heard about was Mike Piazza being the greatest catcher I've ever seen. Let me take it back to the year 1970, when one Johnny Bench not only batted 278 for a catcher, which is outrageous. You never see catchers hitting 278 for the season. Hit 45 bombs, 148 RBIs, and batted 605 times. He has the most at-bats in Major League Baseball that season for a catcher. He never needed a day off, played all 162 games, won the MVP that year. And here's the amazing stat. Roughly 72% of all base runners steal bases. Johnny Bench threw out 53% of everyone who ever ran on him in a 17-year career, all with the Cincinnati Reds. He was the man. Two other things that I love about him. First of all, he's a great ambassador for the game, even though he does that blue emu commercial and it doesn't stink. And he never stank. The other thing that I really take a lot of pride in, and he came after another guy who's going to probably be on my list here. He had no problem hammering on Pete Rose. And I really respected that. I know a lot of people didn't like Johnny Bench for that. If you're part of the old man group, you need to look after the old man. You need to be taking care of the good old boys club. But when Pete Rose came out and said he gambled on baseball, Johnny said, it's wrong. Can't do it. And he's also big time against the steroid area because you know why? He did it right. He did it right and had an incredible career with the Cincinnati Reds. Is still so much beloved up there for the Cincinnati Reds. Great ambassador for the game. But Johnny Bench, man, as long as Johnny Bench is behind the plate, I knew a no-no could be thrown on any given night. Probably called some of the best Major League Baseball games I've ever heard as well.
Yeah, he was awesome. He's almost like a literary character. Johnny Bench from Binger, Oklahoma.
Yes.
It doesn't get any better than that.
And I will share with you, to put it over the top, this was the cherry on top of my sundae. I always made a big deal out of my birthday when I was on the opening drive with Al DiGreco and Jay Barker. 2009, I had turned 43 years old, and Al, because he had played in all these pro-ams and stuff, had gotten some really good phone numbers. John Larroquette called the show one time. So one morning, he has this individual call the show and sing me a happy birthday. I had no clue who it was, and it was Johnny Bench. And Johnny Bench just sang happy birthday to Tone the Bone. It put me over the top. It was over. I was done. Put a fork in me. I'm finished. It was great.
That's awesome.
All right, who else you got?
All right, well, I talked about the first bond with my dad closely at the same time growing up in Washington, D.C. My dad was a lifelong Washington Redskin fan. Not the Washington Commanders, the Washington Redskins. I always joke that the first thing that I was able to read was not See Spot Run, it was See the Seven Horse Run. But the first song that I ever learned was Hail to the Redskins. And I knew every lyric, Hail to the Redskins, Hail Victory, Braves on the Warpath, Fight for All DC. And it was the song. The only problem with that was, Tony, that the Redskins, well, they stunk. They were lousy every year of my childhood. And every year my dad and his rowdy friends would have a big party about this time of year, maybe like mid to late July, getting ready for the new season. They all had season tickets. My grandmother, who my dad was her only child, was very successful and prominent. That was his Christmas present every year, Redskins season tickets. And for a guy in his 20s, you know, he was strutting high and mighty with that. He was going to go to every game. And my mother was supposed to go along. She would go like maybe to the opener. And after that, she decided it wasn't for her. So the rest of the year, I was the guy who kind of wormed in on that other ticket, even as a little kid. The Redskins in 1965 traded for a fellow by the name of Sonny Jurgensen. Sonny Jurgensen, a graduate from Duke University, where my dad attended as a freshman, and actually walked on, tried to stick with the football team after a real strong high school career in the Washington, D.C. area at a place called Randolph-Macon Academy. And yes, it was basically a military high school because my dad needed some supervision, kind of a wild child, which he maintained through the rest of his life. But Sonny Jurgensen was the starter on that Duke team. And my dad, a single wing quarterback in high school, had the opportunity to at least practice with Sonny and knew him a little bit. So when the Redskins acquired Sonny Jurgensen in a trade with the Philadelphia Eagles, there was great excitement in Washington that maybe he could come in and turn the terrible franchise around. Now, Sonny was a modern-day Babe Ruth type, Tony. This is a guy who could probably sit down and eat 25 hot dogs and drink 6 or 8 beers before a game and not miss a beat. He was rotund. He was not athletic looking at all. He was kind of redheaded with a big old, you know, melon head. But Tony, Sonny Jurgensen could fling the rock. He had the arm that you can't even basically even begin to describe. There's a famous NFL Films video of him messing around in practice and throwing spirals perfectly down the field about 30 yards behind his back. Guy had an arm that you just can't believe. And the Redskins actually had some good skill players. Charlie Taylor, a young rookie the year before from Arizona State, was awesome. Bobby Mitchell was an all-pro wide receiver. They had some pieces, and Jurgensen that first year really lit it up and just set Washington on fire. And those guys, it's hard to believe, but you know, they had to do a lot of promotions and hustle on the side, because as a pro athlete, you didn't make very much money in those days. So Sonny Jurgensen was appearing at a car dealership on a weeknight. And my dad took me, and I got an autograph picture and got to hang out with Sonny, the Redskins quarterback, who was the iconic guy in Washington. The bottom line is, unfortunately, the Redskins didn't progress a lot. They got to almost 500. And a few years later, in the very late stages of Jurgensen's career, Vince Lombardi left the Packers and came to Washington for the 1969 season. We had already left and moved to Atlanta by that time. But Jurgensen, in the latest part of his career, when he was basically done, was so inspired by Lombardi, the Redskins actually had a 500 season after only winning two games the year before. So I followed him his whole career. He was colorful. He was interesting. And he was the color man on Redskin radio broadcast for the next 25 years, and was a guy who not only could throw the football over the field, he would throw zingers at whoever he thought deserved it. Very outspoken, just a real colorful guy. One of the real heroes of my youth, Sonny Jurgensen of the Washington Redskins.
Oh man. And another NFL team. And I love that story. Sonny was the man. He could flip the ball. And he was like the Jimi Hendrix of quarterbacks. He could flip the ball upside down, backwards and everything else. Another team that sucked for a long period of time was my Cincinnati Bengals. Of course, they went to a couple Super Bowls against the San Francisco 49ers. Lost both those in 82 and 89. A lot of people who have just got on their bandwagon recently because of Joe Cool Joe Burrow don't realize that the Cincinnati Bengals, I want to say they had like the number one overall pick for like 23 years in a row. At least it felt like that. I think it was actually 4 or 5 years in a row. But there was a guy who was on both of those Super Bowl trying teams against the 49ers. 6'6", 278 pounds, a guy out of USC, actually won a national title with the Trojans, and he was on offensive line. And you know this as well as you don't have to play to know the only way you're going to win a Super Bowl is to have great line play on both sides. Yep. You can have the best quarterback, the best wide receiver, and the best running back. If you don't have a good line, you're not going to get it done. And one, Anthony Munoz was that guy the Cincinnati Bengals just really need to have. And he played pretty much every single year with the Cincinnati Bengals, with the exception of his last year when he played with the Tampa Bay squad. But this player was unbelievable, and of course he still got the bent finger. I don't know if you've ever seen that ring finger on his left hand. It goes totally sideways. It's the most bizarre looking thing ever, but he was just a fantastic player. He won a national title with USC. Something a lot of people don't talk about as well, he met his wife at USC his sophomore year. And yes, he's still married to her. He's a Christian man. He's been married for 45 years. He'll be turning in his mid-60s, I think 68, coming up a little bit later on this August. So he's just a good guy and just a violent sport and just an amazing guy. And I'll leave you with this. In 1984, I started working at a Kentucky Fried Chicken in Sharonville, Ohio, which is right between Westchester and Mason, Ohio. I was from Westchester. So I make the trip down to Sharonville, and I would work every Sunday. I was the chief chicken maker. I was the man. Whenever the Bengals had a home game that was a 3 or 4 p.m. start, depending on Eastern Central Time, Anthony Munoz used to come through our drive-thru at 10:30 in the morning, which is when we opened and dropped our first bucket of chicken. He would order 2 buckets of all original recipe. He loved the keels and he loved the breast meat. He was a white meat man, despite the fact that he was Latino Mexican. He loved the white meat. He would order 2 buckets of chicken with 2 large mashed potatoes and 2 large coleslaws. Then he would bring it in the restaurant and eat it all by himself. And then he would go down and play for the Cincinnati Bengals for a 4 o'clock kick. He did it every single home game, 8 times a year. We go, Anthony's here. I would actually get to work. You know, I was 16, 17 years old. No one gets to work early when you're 16 or 17 years old. My boss would say, don't forget it's a home game tomorrow. And he'd call me up at home. Don't forget it's a home game tomorrow. Uh-huh. You probably need to get here. You need to get here by 10:15 to make sure that chicken's ready for Anthony Munoz, because he's coming through the drive-thru at 10:30. And we just loved it. And I took so much pride. I would actually, you know, when you hand bread chicken at Kentucky Fried Chicken, it is still hand breaded, I believe. I would have hand bred it three times instead of twice just because I knew that Anthony Munoz was getting those 11 herbs and spices. I'll never forget it, man. And he used to come in and we would just sit there and stare at him as he would devour some 40 pieces of chicken, two large potatoes, and biscuits with it, and then a big gulp of Coca-Cola. It was the most amazing thing, but he was so good. He was such a great player. And really, I mean, if you're on the offensive or defensive lines, and more so on the defensive lines now just because you can play spy and you can make tackles and everything else. But offensive players just get they're so underrated and they're so important. And we saw that with the Bengals this past year when they lost 3/5 of their line. I think they started 3-5. They came out of the box, and once they got healthy and got some free agents in there, they all made it all the way almost to the Super Bowl again, losing to Kansas City. But just an unbelievable player. And again, played his entire life with the Cincinnati Bengals with the exception of 1 year. But Anthony Munoz would be my childhood hero for sure. Who you got next, my man? I can't wait to hear.
That's an incredible story. Okay, I gave you my early childhood in Washington, D.C. My whole world was disrupted in a little bit later at the ripe old age of 8 years old in third grade. My father was working for Johnson Wax. He was a salesman selling Glade and Pledge and Raid and all the great products that that Johnson Wax had, Bravo, and I can rattle them off, Glow Coat, all the different products. But anyway, he was raised to a district manager job, big promotion for him, very exciting for his sales performance. But it required us to relocate to the ATL, Atlanta, Georgia. Atlanta was just starting to be on the rise with the advent of the Hartsfield-Jackson Airport. It wasn't Jackson yet. Maynard Jackson had not yet been mayor. That's what it is today. Of course, the largest, busiest airport in the world, which really transformed Atlanta. Immediately, all kinds of corporations started to relocate there. Football and baseball came to Atlanta at the same time, followed soon thereafter by the Atlanta Hawks, who came from St. Louis. Atlanta just blew up in the late 60s, and the Kiefer family was part of that. We moved from Rockville, Maryland to Dunwoody, Georgia, just the close suburb to Atlanta. And what an exciting time it turned out to be. And everybody that I still know to this day, and my best friends and all of my memories, that became, you know, when you say, ask me where my hometown was, I don't say Washington because Atlanta was a lot more dominant in that equation. But with all that being said, my parents flew down. My grandmother took care of us while my mom and dad went to Atlanta to look for a house and flew back, successfully completing their mission, found the house in the burgeoning suburbs of Dunwoody North. But they walked in the door, and I was, as you already heard, pretty obsessed with sports. I had just gotten in that summer to collecting en masse baseball cards and had boxes and boxes. Every time we left the house, I demanded a couple of packs of cards. I had to do chores and stuff to be able to, you know, be allocated I think they were a dime or 20 cents a pack, but it wasn't a major expenditure for the family. But I started to get a lot of cards, and my aforementioned grandmother really enhanced my collection by giving me two full boxes of cards. Wow. Which was like getting buried treasure, because you just open pack after pack.
Isn't
after
it great?
Pack.
Wasn't it great?
Oh man, it was so awesome. So I had them all sorted out in teams. There wasn't a lot of sports on TV in those days. Only one baseball game a week was on Saturdays. But my dad came in and kind of nudged my mother and said, okay, well, we got a new house. Who's the shortstop for the Atlanta Braves? And I said, and that was the first year they were in Atlanta, by the way. They just moved from Milwaukee. And I said, Dennis Menke? And he laughed and nudged my mom and said, I told you he would know. He says, he's your new next door neighbor. Which I couldn't believe it. We're moving to Atlanta, and I'm going to live next door to a Major League Baseball player. I mean, Tony, I hit the kid lottery, the sports fanatic kid lottery. We moved down there, the Menkes, Dennis and Gene Menke, right next door, didn't have any kids. He had been one of the highest paid, what was called in those days, bonus babies, because he was determined to go to the University of Iowa. That was his plan all along, and play baseball there first. The Braves drafted him, gave him, it's some kind of laughable amount. Now, I think they paid him maybe $100,000 bonus, which now that's pocket change for these guys. But he signed with the Braves and had a great rookie year. He had 20 home runs in their last year in Milwaukee. Moved down with the Braves. That team had Hank Aaron, of course, closing in on Babe Ruth. They had a lot of luminary performers, Phil Niekro, Cleet Boyer, Rico Carty, Orlando Cepeda. That original Braves team so well, and they came to Atlanta and took the city by storm in old Atlanta Fulton County Stadium. But we became fast friends with the Menkes next door. Before you knew it, when the season rolled around, Jean Menke, his wife, who was so great to me, they didn't have any kids at the time, but they kind of de facto adopted me, let me hang around and talk to Dennis. And, kids were always coming and ringing his doorbell, trying to get autographs. And I was at elite status there. You know, that's I didn't worry about those things, but, this went on for a couple of years. I cut their grass, and took care of their dogs when they were gone, et cetera. And, when they adopted their first child, I had gotten to be about 11, I think, or 12 years old, and was even entrusted with babysitting and such. But the bottom line is that all changed in 1969, one of the dark days of my youth, when Dennis Menke was traded to the Houston Astros.
Oh, man.
I was devastated. So, but they still lived there for another year until he was traded again. And you'll like the place he ended up this time, because you just talked about it. He was a member of the 1970 Cincinnati Reds team, the big red machine. Dennis Menke was added for defense in the infield. They were playing Pete at third base a lot. Dennis came in toward the second half of the season, played a lot of third, but the biggest part of that trade wasn't Dennis Menke. A guy named Joe Morgan was also involved in that seven-player deal with the Astros. And another guy named Cesar Geronimo. So pretty good haul for the Reds in that trade with the Astros. I can't remember exactly. I know the Reds gave up Tommy Helms, who was a longtime staple with the Reds, and a couple other guys. But those guys were on that great team. And in 72, Menke was actually playing third for the Reds in the World Series. Against the Oakland A's, and you'll remember the play. You probably don't remember it was Dennis that hit the ball, but there was a key play and late in game five when the Reds, basically a game, I think they were already down in the series 2-1. I might not have been game five, but it was a pivotal game that they needed to win. The Reds had two guys on with two outs in the eighth inning. Dennis Menke hit a huge drive to the left field corner. It looked like it was going to get out of the park. And Joe Rudy for the Oakland A's made an unbelievable catch that you still see in highlight reels to this day, taking a home run away from Dennis Menke and really kind of robbing him of his World Series immortality moment for the Reds. But he was on those great teams, and we would make trips, me and my high school classmates, to Cincinnati, and he would get us tickets, and we would be at Riverfront, and got to watch Johnny Bench and Pete Rose and all those guys for the couple of years that he was still with the Reds until he was traded back to Houston. But the bottom line was, what a great opportunity for a kid. I idolized Dennis Menke, not as so much a baseball player, but just a person, because they couldn't have been any better to me, and it couldn't have made my childhood I can't imagine a better scenario for a young kid moving at 8 years old to Atlanta and actually having those people in my life and continue to correspond a little bit now, even though they're down in Clearwater. He was working as a hitting instructor for the Phillies until just a couple of years ago when he retired. He's in his mid 80s, but the Menkes, big heroes in my life, both he and his wife, Jean.
I don't think people realize too, that 1976 squad that he was on, they had 8 All-Stars that year. We got an All-Star game going on later on tonight as we record here on July 11th. They had 8 All-Star guys. There were 5 players on that baseball team that were starting there with the Cincinnati Reds. Great story. You brought up earlier, and this is the Kiefer and Curry Show. We're talking about our childhood heroes in sports. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Info at Tony. TonyCurryRadio.net. Download that TKR app. Now you can get TKR on Android and Apple. Of course, you can always get Tony Curry Radio on Android, but now just search TKR, three letters. It's going to get you home. You can listen to the show as many times as you want on our podcast. Before there was the Wild World of Sports, and before there was Red Bull Stunts, there was the Wild World of Sports. We weren't watching because of Jim McKay. We were watching it because of a guy who broke 206 bones in his body. And by the way, folks, that's all we have, 206 bones. That would be Evel Knievel. Evel Knievel was the reason I started watching sports, period, despite the fact that motorcycle jumping at the time wasn't really considered a sport. He's sitting in a jail cell in Butte, Montana at the age of 18 after he just got arrested for going 113 and a 35 on a motorcycle. They put him behind bars. And someone said, you know what? You're pure evil, dude. You're just evil. You don't drive 80 miles over the speed limit. What the hell's wrong with you? And he went, evil?
Evil
Knievel. That kind of rhymes a little bit. And thus the history was born. A guy who made 75 ramp-to-ramp jumps. We could go through all of them if you wanted to, and I would love to do that. But, of course, the ones that I remember most, the Wembley jump, the jump where I was working at Kings Island Music Park, I got goosebumps that would come through the computer screen right now. The Snake River Canyon, despite the fact it was horrible. And the only thing I didn't like about that was because it wasn't on a motorcycle. It was in, and obviously that's why it didn't work. And then, of course, one that you'll remember and you'll love, the one that he jumped the fountains in Caesars. I mean, it was unbelievable. And here's the crazy thing. And people right now, they're jumping three times as far now. Why couldn't Evel do it? He was riding a Norton 750cc motorcycle. It was the equivalent, it was the equivalent of jumping 26 buses in a Harley Davidson. And later on, he was in a Triumph. He rode a Triumph 650. We're talking a huge engine. We're not talking these little mini bikes, these things that can fly and you can move to the side and stuff. You're talking like jumping Caesars in a Harley Davidson. It was unbelievable. And of course, really his claim to fame for me anyway, just because I'm 57 years old, he was the first to do the shark jump. And you know what happened after he did the shark jump? Some other guy named Henry Winkler as Fonzie did the shark jump. And we still use the phrase jump the sharks because of something that Evel Knievel started first. But man, I remember watching the Worldwide of Sports, ABC's Wild World of Sports. And we would wait hours for Evel Knievel to make his jump. It was supposed to start like at 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I remember one time, I want to say it was a Caesars jump. He went up and down that ramp about 35 times before he, and every time he'd go, you'd think it was going to be it. I think he was playing up to the crowd to do that. But when he jumped Caesars Fountain, just an unbelievable, and to actually see that, and it was live. I mean, you're going to see a guy, you can see a guy die live on television. We never had that in sports, period. Evel Knievel is a guy that I'll always remember as a childhood hero of mine.
That's awesome. And that's true. People don't realize now because everything we see is as it's happening. That was very unusual back in the day, particularly for Wide World of Sports, because I still remember so much Jim McKay, who was another hero of mine. He was from Maryland, where I was originally from in the D.C. area. But remember spanning the globe to bring you the constant variety of sports, the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat. Yes. This is Wide World of Sports. And they went all over the world, literally, in that era, Tony, which was just incredible to start with. And really introduced Americans to sports from throughout the globe. It was a phenomenal show. And Evel Knievel, I remember that now as you say it. That was so hyped up. This is going to be absolutely live because that was unprecedented.
It was unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
It was unbelievable. All right, so here's your final one.
All right, now we're getting into my teenage years in Atlanta because I mentioned the Braves came from Milwaukee. The Falcons were formed as an expansion team. And the St. Louis Hawks, just off a championship in 1967, moved to Atlanta and became the Atlanta Hawks. Unfortunately, it's 2023, and the Atlanta Hawks have never won another championship. It's you talk about long droughts. The Atlanta Hawks have not won a championship in now, do the math, 56 years in Atlanta, and have only been to the NBA Finals once in all that time, but they roll merrily along. But I'm not going to pick a Hawk, even though there were some fantastic ones. The Hawks, due to some chicanery right at draft time, were able to acquire the pick to take Pete Maravich. So got to see the pistol as an Atlanta Hawk. But in the NBA, he was never quite the same as he was at LSU. So He doesn't make my list, but he gets an honorable mention, of course, because there was nobody like the Pistol. But when the Atlanta Flames came to Atlanta, an expansion team in the NHL in hockey in 1971, that was a big deal. And, of course, they were able to, along with another new team, the New York Islanders, have the first ever draft picks. The first two draft picks automatically in those drafts, the Atlanta Flames selected a young man from Medicine Hat, Alberta. Now, how's that for a storybook place to be from in Canada? His name, Tony, was Tom Lysiak. Tom Lysiak came to Atlanta as a brash young rookie in a town that didn't know hockey, or the only thing ice was good for was the 5 o'clock drink. But all of a sudden, this big sheet of ice in the Omni in Atlanta was downtown. The Flames took the town by storm. People loved hockey, and it was an amazing success in Atlanta in that first experiment. The Flames were drafted. They acquired a lot of veterans, a lot of kind of just rough and tumble guys, because they wanted the sport to catch on there in a city that had no background. The Islanders, on the other hand, also came in the league, drafted nothing, and really traded for draft picks and strengthened themselves. Were within 4 or 5 years, they won a Stanley Cup. The Flames went a different direction because they had to be competitive right away. They couldn't come in and just be a joke and have any hopes of succeeding. And Tom Lysiak, who was a 21-year-old rookie, just absolutely just turned the town on its ear. This was an era, Tony, where the players were not required to wear helmets. And guys like Tom Lysiak absolutely refused to wear one. He had the flowing locks and was, you know, every girl in town was in love with him. And every guy, he was their idol because he was tough. You know, guys challenged him and he would hold his own and for the most part, you know, win his fights, because there were a lot of fights. It's not like modern day hockey where it's like a aberration that something breaks out. If you went to an NHL game, of course, the old joke, I think it was a Rodney Dangerfield's joke, you know, I went to a fight the other day and a hockey game broke out. But, you know, that was really the nature of things. It was really a rough sport, very physical. And the Flames were just such a phenomenon. And Tom Lysiak was a great goal scorer, he was the Mickey Mantle of Atlanta sports. And to this day, I don't think there's been, and Atlanta's had quite a few iconic players, but I don't think anybody has ever matched the popularity of Tom Lysiak. All of us had our number 12 Lysiak jerseys. We were Lysiak's legion. We were his biggest fans. And just like I told you, the Menke trade, the death of the Atlanta Flames before they moved to Calgary, where they still are today, was later on when the team, who was undercapitalized to start with, Tom Lysiak, the absolute hockey hero in Atlanta, was traded to the Chicago Blackhawks, and it was the biggest betrayal. The whole city went into just absolute gloom and doom, and the Flames 2 years later were sold and moved to Canada, where they still remain today. And people say, well, are you still a Flames fan? And I said, well, no. There's no original Atlanta Flames on that team. There were some, of course, the year that they moved, but the Flames' other legacy was they could never win a playoff series despite having some really good teams, but they stood toe-to-toe at that time with the dominant team in the league, the Philadelphia Flyers, who had nothing but a bunch of brawlers and scorers, and they were just a wild outfit. Just great memories. We found a way to go to every game. We'd go down there and hustle tickets. We didn't have 50 cents between us, but we would wheel and deal and somehow get into just about every game. And I told you this year on this show a couple of times that reliving that kind of similar experience with my sons in Las Vegas gave me a chance to have kind of a hockey rebirth and figure out why I fell in love so much with that sport, watching Las Vegas not only have a similar trajectory to being immediately competitive, but actually winning a Stanley Cup this year. And I had thoughts of Tom Lysiak, who we lost to pancreatic cancer about 7 or 8 years ago at way too early an age. But he will always be basically my Mickey Mantle to kids that grew up in the 50s. Every kid idolized Mickey Mantle. for us, it was a hockey player from Medicine Hat, Alberta named Tom Wozniak.
I love that story. That's fantastic. We're hitting animals, four-legged jobbers. We got hockey. I'm going to go back to Major League Baseball here. I was going to go with Marty and Joe, but I didn't want to be too specific to the Cincinnati area, despite the fact that I think a lot of people in baseball or love Marty and Joe and what they did. They were together for a long time. Before Shohei Ohtani, though, came on board, there was another player who was an all-star, not in one, not in two, not in three, not in four, but five different positions. An all-star in five different positions, and during his 24-year career, played all nine positions during Major League Baseball seasons. That'd be Peter Edward Rose. A little trivia question for you. He gets his 3,000th hit on May 5th, 1978. Do you know who he was with when he got his 4,000th hit?
I think he was in Montreal.
He was. He was a Montreal Expo when he got his 4,000th hit. The Reds, they planned it pretty good. 1978, they wanted to get his 3,000th hit with the Cincinnati Reds. He gets traded to the Philadelphia Phillies the following season. And, of course, as soon as he gets his 4,000th hit, the Reds made the deal to bring him back to Cincinnati to get, hopefully, the 41-92, which, of course, he did. He finished with 42-56. He finished tops with most singles, most hits, most games played, most at-bats. And, ironically enough, he's also holding the Major League Baseball record, which will never be broken, for the most outs. At 10,378, he made more outs than any Major League Baseball player, but his baseball average in 24 years, a .303 average. You'll never see anything like that again. He was just an amazing baseball player, and of course, he captured the world when his 44-game hitting streak. I was at the 45th game, which of course, he went hitless in that particular game. He went 4-for-5 in game 46. I remember thinking to myself, why could you not take a couple of those singles and back him up a day? Everyone thought he was going to beat Joe there with the 56-game hitting streak, but I'll tell you a story. I was in first year college at Xavier in 1988. We had a Sunday night league at St. Susanna's up in Mason, Ohio. I was playing for the St. John's Red River or something or other. I forget the name of our team. Of course, we had a glove in one hand and a beer in the other. It was a fantastic league. We had these two guys named the Hunklers who could knock the ball out of any ballpark we played in on our on our cheese league. We called them the Hunklers. And I think that was the real name, Hunklers. And so before the game, we had to prime the pump, literally and figuratively. And so we went up to Mason, Ohio, right outside St. Susanna's, and there was a batting cage up there. And we're sitting there, and of course, there's an 80, 85, 90, and a 95-mile-an-hour batting cage. And of course, we're hitting the slow-pitch softball because we're pitching softball league. And someone said, hey, go down to the last cage on the left. You're not going to believe who's down there hitting the 95-mile-an-hour baseballs. And so I walked down there, and there's Pete Rose. In the batting cage on a Sunday night, on an off night, hitting baseballs in a batting cage in Mason, Ohio. And here's the incredible thing. As you, in most batting cages, it goes out at an angle almost like a triangle, right? It's not straight. It goes out in a curve so you can see whether you're flaring the ball right and left and you can switch hit. He had pieces of 8x10 typewriter paper close-pinned to those wires every 6 feet up and down the line. There were 13 on each side of the line. He could tell you which piece of paper he was going to hit with the next ball. It was the most amazing thing. He's like, I'm going to hit number 12 on the right. And he would switch hit. He would go left-handed, right-handed. He goes, I'm going to hit number 9 on the left. I'm going to hit number 3. It was the most amazing thing I have ever seen in my life. It got to the point where I thought to myself, the guy could hit any ball. It was just incredible. It was amazing. He also had a game where he had 160 bombs. He had a game where he had a 3-home-run game. A 3-home game for Pete Rose. So, I mean, I hate the fact that he's not in the Hall of Fame. It's on him that he's not. If he would just come and get on his knees and just say, listen, I screwed up and I'll never do it again to Manfred. If he'd do it, they'd probably let him in. I know he's going to get into the Hall of Fame, but it's going to be after he dies. It's going to be a Kenny Stabler situation where they're not going to allow him to enjoy that. And of course, he certainly pushed a lot of buttons and pushed the envelope. He sits outside. He's in Cooperstown. He's just not inside the building. He's outside of it every time they have Major League Baseball's class come in. He's always out there signing autographs. So they go for about $3 or $4 on eBay, by the way, if you want a Pete Rose autograph. But one of those guys where he was Charlie Hustle. And you talk about those great clips that they show every single year. They still show them. They don't show it anymore only because you're not allowed to block the play anymore. But the Pete Rose, Ray Fosse, situation in the 1970 All-Star game where he knocked the teeth out of Ray Foss literally at home plate during an All-Star game. And people were like, it's an All-Star game. Don't hurt yourself. Pete didn't care, man. He played every single out like it was his last out. He also holds the record for stretching the most singles in the doubles. You knew that if he hit a ball on the ground and got through the hole, he was going to go for two. He's just one of the most exciting baseball players I've ever seen, and I don't think we'll ever see anybody like him again. Bryce Harper, when he came on the scene, was the first guy in a walk who would run down to first base. And they're like, what the hell is this guy doing? Is he showing him up? No. He loves Major League Baseball. He's a hustler. He gets after, despite the fact he's been banged up so much of his career. He loves Major League Baseball, and people hate him for that. I love Pete Rose for everything he did.
I've been a Pete Rose guy forever. I told you last summer I was lucky enough to be at Cooperstown and was very happy to see that Pete is inside, but he's not enshrined. Yes. But he's... there's a display. They do acknowledge that he has more hits than anybody else. So there he is. There's his uniform and his bat and all of that. So I was appreciating the fact because I didn't know that was actually in the building, and that was awesome. And I said to Mark, my friend who was with me, I said, well, it's good to see Pete's in here. And the guy standing next to me said, Tony, under his breath, well, he bet on baseball. And I turned to the guy, goes, oh, baseball. The sport that's official betting partner is FanDuel. That's not hypocrisy. And the guy kind of walked away and goes, that was way over that guy's head.
Oh, my gosh. You can bet on Major League Baseball games inside Great American Ballpark now. You can actually bet on Reds games. It's ridiculous.
Or at Alabama games. That's where that scandal started, as Case explained to us.
It sure was.
So, you know, it's amazing. I'll tell you real quick. I know we're short on time, but I went to a doubleheader Reds Braves back in the really great Reds era. And in the first game, the Reds just bombarded them. And that's when you played two. At starting at 6:05, you took a 40-minute break and you played the second game. It went to well after midnight. So the Reds were like a gazillion games ahead in the division. They were going to win there. The games meant nothing. This was like, I think it may have been early September. And the Reds won 14-2 in the first game or something. All the regulars played in the nightcap. Pete Rose and the Reds were actually behind the Braves 5-4 going to the top of the ninth. Pete was leading off the inning, and he hit a high chopper toward third, Tony, that looked like a routine play. The fielder for the Braves, I don't remember who the third base was, but he fielded it cleanly, made the throw, but somehow Pete Rose was digging so hard down the line, he beat out that seemingly routine ground ball to first. To third, and later in the inning, somebody hit squeezed one through the hole on the right side. He went first to third without any hesitation. Next thing you know, the sacrifice fly, game tied. The Reds went in extra innings in a meaningless second game of doubleheader. But that had such an impression on me as a young teenager of how to play the game right. And it to this day that resonates, and I always tell that story anytime I get the chance, because this is a guy who, you know, it drives me nuts in modern day sports when they actually praise a guy that's making $40 million a year for hustling. Amen. He really hustled down the line. Well, good for him.
Amen.
You know, he can actually try hard in the period where he's making about, you know, however many millions of dollars for playing a game. Pete Rose did that every day that he played the game, and there was, like you said, no inning or no occasion where that wasn't in play. His dad had taught him the right way to play, and that's how he played, and I wish some modern-day athletes had that same kind of attitude.
Well said, my friend. Kiefer and Curry Show, you can hear it every single week right here on the TKR app, now available, of course, on Android through TKR as well. It's always been available through Android, but now just put in TKR. You don't have to spell out Tony Curry. People are like, how do you spell that Curry name? It's K-U-R-R-E, but you don't have to worry about that anymore. TKR, get the app. You can hear the show at least 5 days a week. Also, Need to Know, which is a fantastic show that Kip does every single week. And, of course, wherever you get your podcasts, we're available on every major industry. There's not one that we're not available on. Tony Curry Radio. So get out there and check us out. All of our great shows. Well over 1,000 podcasts and counting. We'll do it again next week. Kip, thank you so much, man. Appreciate you.
Tony, it's been great. Thank you.
This has been a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.